Discovering How Trouble Starts and Stops. The second noble truth is sources of suffering. After identifying the scope of suffering, we need to discover its sources, which are twofold: afflictive or counterproductive emotions, and contaminated karmas. Since afflictive emotions are what contaminate karmas or actions, I will discuss afflictive emotions first. There are two classes of afflictive emotions, one that is better expressed and the other that is better not expressed. An example of the type that is better to express is a terrible fear from the past that has become fixed in the mind. In this case, it is definitely beneficial to let your feelings out and discuss the incident. When I was around 14 years old, during the summer at the Norberlinger Palace, the regent, who at that time was my senior tutor, scolded me after a teaching that he gave annually. With a harsh demeanor, he said, "Even if your realization is equal to a god's, your behavior still has to conform to a human being's." I was hurt because I felt that I was already acting as an ordinary student, listening to him, even though I was the Dalai Lama, ranking above him. I was irritated and remained uncomfortable for the next few months. Then the Chinese communists invaded eastern Tibet in 1950, and I had to escape from Lhasa to Tromo in southwestern Tibet near the Indian border. In time, officials in Lhasa advised me that the situation looked workable and that I should return. While on the way back to Lhasa, we spent several days at the regent's monastery, Dalungtra. One day he asked during a casual chat whether, because of his attitude, I ever had become upset. I mentioned what had happened, somewhat vaguely, without much detail. What a relief this was! We went on to have a pleasant stay at the monastery. It is better to talk about such things that occur only once, whereas the other class of counterproductive emotions, which include such feelings as lust, hatred, enmity, jealousy, or belligerence, should not be expressed. They become more and more frequent if they are. Expressing them tends to make them stronger and more prevalent. It is better to reflect on the disadvantages of engaging in such emotions and to try to displace them with feelings of satisfaction and love. We should forcefully overcome negative emotions when they appear, but it would be even better to find ways to prevent them in the first place. Lust and hatred give rise to other counterproductive emotions and thereby create a whole lot of trouble in this world. We cannot be content to live with the consequences of lust and hatred. Of the two, hatred is worse on an immediate basis because it so quickly brings harm to others. But lust is responsible for driving on the whole process of cyclic existence, the repeated round of birth, aging, sickness, and death from lifetime to lifetime. The root of lust and hatred is ignorance of the true nature of all living beings, as well as ignorance of the nature of inanimate things. This ignorance is not just lack of knowledge, but a consciousness that imagines the exact opposite of the truth. It misapprehends what is actually so. There are many levels of misperception, as in failing to understand what to adopt and practice and what to discard in daily behavior. But here we are talking about the ignorance at the root of all suffering. This is the notion that sentient beings and other phenomena exist inherently, exist in and of themselves. I will discuss this difficult topic later. All pleasure and pain depend on karmas or former actions that have created predispositions in the mind. Karmas can be divided into virtuous and non-virtuous, according to whether they produce pleasure or pain in the long run. For instance, if the effect of an action is to establish a new human life, then that action is virtuous, because its long-term effect is a good transmigration. Conversely, if the effect of an action is to cause your rebirth as a hungry ghost, then that action is non-virtuous, because its long-term effect is a bad transmigration. Karmas can also be divided into those that etch the general outline of a new lifetime by determining the type of birth as well as the length of life, and those that fill in the details of a lifetime, such as prosperity, good health, and so on. The former type is called a path of action, because that action, whether virtuous or not, serves as a path or a means to a complete lifetime in either a happy transmigration or a bad transmigration. To be a path of action, a karma must have four characteristics: motivating intention, correct identification of the person or object, proper preparation, and successful completion. Sometimes all of these factors occur, as in the case where you intend to give to a beggar and actually do so. Sometimes only the motivation is present, and you intend to give to a beggar but do not actually do so. Or you may get the result unintentionally. If some money drops through a hole in your pocket onto the sidewalk and a beggar picks it up, actions that do not have all four characteristics could fall into the second category, which fills in the details of a lifetime. Finally, karmas can be divided into those performed by groups, such as organized charities or nations, and those undertaken individually. The effects of karmas can be experienced in the same life, in the next life, or in a life after that. Strong virtuous or non-virtuous karmas with a powerful motivation to help or to harm can yield their effects during the same life. In order to understand the types of karma and the special features of the highest levels of practice, we need to understand the dynamics of three stages: the process of death, the intermediate state between this lifetime and the next, and the process of rebirth out of the intermediate state. The transmission of karmas from one lifetime to another occurs at death through a very subtle mind of clear light. Although this deepest level of mind exists throughout life, it is manifest at death, and therefore is often taught in this context. This topic is discussed in many texts of highest yoga tantra, which were spoken by Buddha, such as the Guhya Samaja Tantra. These texts describe the many different categories of mind or consciousness, ranging from gross to subtle. Subtler states of mind are more powerful and effective when applied in spiritual practice. The grossest level of consciousness perceives through the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body. More subtle is mental consciousness, which itself ranges from gross levels, such as ordinary thought, to deep sleep and fainting when the breath has stopped, to the innermost subtle mind of clear light. Except in extraordinary meditative states, the subtlest or deepest consciousness manifests itself only when we are dying. Less withdrawn and therefore brief versions of the subtle levels of consciousness also occur when going to sleep, ending a dream, sneezing, yawning, and during orgasm. I will discuss the last of these later. The process of dying involves a serial cessation or dissolution of the four internal elements: earth, which is the hard substance of the body; water, which is its fluids; fire, which is the body's heat; and wind, which is energy or movement. In ordinary life, these elements serve as the basis for consciousness. but during the process of dying, their capacity to support consciousness decreases, beginning with the earth element. Each step in this dissolution actually increases the capacity of the next element to support consciousness. Step by step, it looks like this. 1. When the earth element, or hard substances of your body, dissolves into the water element, the external indication is that your body becomes thinner. Internally, you see what appears to be a mirage scene in a desert. 2. When the water element of your body dissolves into the fire element, the external signs are that the fluids in your body dry. Your mouth dries, your nose puckers, and so forth. Internally, you see what has been described as puffs of smoke from a chimney, or smoke floating throughout a room. 3. When the fire element of your body dissolves into the wind or air element, the external indication is that the heat in your body diminishes. Internally, you see what look like fireflies at night or like scattering sparks. Heat withdraws from the body in various ways, from the feet upward to the heart or from the top of the head down. The former is preferable, because it indicates that the mind will exit the body either upward or straight forward, not downward, and thus will most likely lead to a favorable next lifetime. This is caused by virtuous karma. 4. The wind, or movement of energy in your body, dissolves into consciousness, and your outer breath, your usual breath, ceases. At this time, you see an appearance like the light above a flickering candle flame when the fuel has almost been used up. Some doctors would consider a person in this state to be dead, but from the Buddhist point of view, the mere cessation of the usual outer breath does not mean that consciousness has left the body. Then, the flickering light is followed by the appearance of a steady flame. Following that, the final four phases of dying involve the dissolution of grosser levels of consciousness into subtler. This happens when the winds or inner energies that serves as the mounts of consciousness dissolve. Think of consciousness as mounted on energy, like a rider on a horse. In preparation for the next phase, the energies that served as the mounts of the many types of conceptual consciousnesses dissolve, shifting the basis of consciousness from grosser to subtler levels of energy. These naturally occur in four phases, which follow the ones I just gave. Number 5. Your mind itself turns into an omnipresent, huge, vivid, white vastness. It is described as a clear sky filled with moonlight, not the moon shining in empty space, but that space filled with white light. Conceptual thought has vanished, and nothing appears except this vivid whiteness, which is your consciousness. However, a subtle sense of subject and object remains, so the state is slightly dualistic. 6. Your mind turns into a red or orange vastness, more vivid than before. Nothing else appears. It is like a clear sky filled with sunlight, not the sun shining in the sky, but space itself filled with red or orange light. In this state, the mind is even less dualistic. 7. Your mind itself turns into a still more subtle, vividly black state. Nothing else appears. This is called near attainment because you are close to manifesting the mind of clear light. The mind of black vastness is like a moonless, very dark sky just after dusk when no stars are seen. In the beginning of this phase, you are aware, but then you lose awareness as you slip into even thicker darkness. 8. When the mind of black appearance ceases, your mind itself turns into the fully aware mind of clear light. Called the fundamental innate mind of clear light, this is the most subtle, profound, and powerful level of consciousness. It is like the sky's natural state at dawn, not sunrise, without moonlight, sunlight, or darkness. The passage through to the mind of clear light can be fast or slow. Some people remain in the final stage, the mind of clear light of death, for only several minutes. Others stay for as long as a week or two. Since the mind of clear light is so powerful, it is valuable to practice. Therefore, many Tibetan practitioners rehearse these stages of dying on a daily basis. I myself practice them 6 times daily by imagining the 8 levels of mind one by one, without, of course, the physical changes in the first 4 stages. The 8 levels of mind are mirage, smoke, fireflies, flame of a candle, vivid white sky mind, vivid red or orange sky mind, vivid black sky mind, and clear light. In the process of dying, we know that the person is still in the clear light as long as the body does not begin to smell or rot. There are Tibetans who have been tortured and, upon being returned to their jail cells, sit cross-legged in the process of death, sustaining the mind of clear light. Reportedly, their Chinese communist prison guards have been amazed by this. From the viewpoint of their own dogmatism, they regard Buddhism as blind faith. So when they are faced with such evidence, they try to keep quiet about it. In India, too, quite a number of practitioners have remained in this state, sometimes for a few days, and in one case for around 17 days. When a person is abiding in the state of clear light, if the energy that supports this deep level of mind begins to fluctuate, at that point consciousness finally leaves the body and the body or head shifts slightly. There are many opportunities for further investigation into the stages of death. Modern science has done a great deal of research on energy waves, the human brain, and its functions. Scientists and Buddhists share a common interest in this area, and I believe we should work together to probe the relationship between the mind and its inner energies and between the brain and consciousness. Buddhist explanations can contribute to scientific research and vice versa. This kind of cooperation is already underway, and more would be helpful. All beings who are to be reborn as humans pass through an intermediate state between this lifetime and the next. In this intermediate state, your body takes on a shape that resembles your body in the next life at age 5 or 6. However, some say that this is not necessarily so. When the intermediate life ends, the bridge to the next lifetime has been crossed. This process is carried out by the subtlest level of mind. With regard to rebirth, consciousness enters the womb when the male and female fertilizing elements mix together. This is provided there is nothing wrong in the womb or with the sperm, and provided all the favorable factors such as karmic connection are present. However, consciousness does not necessarily have to enter at the time when the male and female are in union. For even in our own texts, there are accounts of the father's semen being inserted into the vagina separately from intercourse. It seems that whether these elements come together inside or, as sometimes is the case nowadays, outside the womb in vitro, consciousness would have to enter while they mix. Still, it is difficult to arrive at a decisive explanation from Buddhist texts since some books say that fertilization takes place when male and female are at a point of strong desire. This complex subject becomes more complicated in modern times. Consider an instance when an embryo is refrigerated. Once the connection has been made from the past life to the new life through fertilization, would that being whose embryonic body is refrigerated undergo the suffering of cold? The very beginning of the body has already been established. And so, according to our explanations, the organ of bodily feeling has already primitively formed, even though the organs of vision and so forth have not. Is there physical sensation from the next moment after fertilization? I have not come to a decision on these points. They are topics for much discussion. If we assume that the being in the embryo does suffer cold, this raises the question of whether the person who puts the embryo in the refrigerator accumulates bad karma from that action. This would depend on the person's motivation. We cannot say that just because another being undergoes suffering due to something that is somehow involved with you, you would accumulate bad karma. For instance, even in normal circumstances, a fetus in the mother's womb undergoes suffering due to being in the womb, but the mother does not accumulate any bad karma. Similarly, when the child is born, it suffers again, but the mother does not accumulate any bad karma. If she did, a mother who gave birth to many children would have accumulated a great deal of bad karma, which is absurd. Therefore, a person's motivation is the key to determine what type of karma accumulates. The third noble truth is that of true cessations. Since defilements of the mind, such as lust, hatred, jealousy, and belligerence, are based on a fundamental misconception of the nature of persons and objects, the process of overcoming them requires a solution to that ignorance. The question becomes how to uproot the ignorance that is the cause of suffering. It cannot be pulled out like a thorn or removed through surgery. In order to overcome this misconception of the nature of persons and things, you have to understand their true nature. Then, through continued meditation, you become accustomed to the truth and increase the power of wisdom to undermine negative emotions rooted in ignorance. At this point, an explanation of emptiness would be helpful, since this is what wisdom realizes about the nature of persons and things, but this will be discussed later. In brief, the fact that defilements such as afflictive emotions can be extinguished at all is due to the mind not being impure by nature. The mind has a pure essence. Defilements are purified through meditation on the true nature, both of the mind and of all other things. Extinguishing these defilements is the third noble truth of cessation, a state beyond suffering and its causes. The fourth noble truth is true paths. True paths refer to three ways of training that are the principal topics of this program: morality, concentrated meditation, and wisdom. Spiritual practice along these paths leads to true cessations, culminating in nirvana and eventually Buddhahood. From beginningless time, we have had a valid awareness or consciousness of I. This I, or self, naturally and innately wants happiness and does not want suffering. And this desire is valid. It is true. It is reasonable. Consequently, all of us have the right to achieve happiness and banish suffering. The fact that suffering and happiness themselves change from moment to moment indicates that these experiences depend upon causes and conditions. In order to get rid of suffering, we need to eliminate the causes and conditions of suffering. And in order to achieve happiness, we need to acquire the causes and conditions of happiness. The first two noble truths apply to the impure phenomena which we want to get rid of, these being true sufferings, which are the effects, and true sources, which are the causes. The final two noble truths are pure states which we want to attain, these being true cessations, which are the effects, and true paths, which are the causes. The way Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, they contain two sequences, one of suffering, which we seek to abandon, and one of happiness, which we seek to adopt. Summary for daily practice. Remember this. Having recognized the scope of suffering, research its causes or sources, and identify that the source of suffering is ignorance of the true nature of persons and things, which results in lust, hatred, and so forth. Realize that suffering can be removed. It can be extinguished into the sphere of reality. Reflect that this true cessation is attained through the practice of morality, concentrated meditation, and wisdom, the true paths. Refraining from harm. Buddhists take a vow of morality in the context of first taking refuge in Buddha, in the states of realization, and in the spiritual community. Refuge is the foundation for the practice of morality. Buddha teaches us how to find refuge from suffering and limitation. But the chief refuge or source of protection is found in the states of realization achieved through practicing morality, concentrated meditation, and wisdom. Buddhist scriptures recommend that you hide your good qualities and achievements like a lamp inside a vessel. You should not advertise them unless there is great purpose in doing so. It is considered a minor infraction of a monastic's vow if he or she achieves the state of liberation and says to someone else, "I have attained liberation." This being the case, it is difficult to determine what stage of inner experience another person has achieved. I have had the opportunity to meet several people who have attained extraordinary spiritual development. There was a not very scholarly monk from my Namgyal monastery who came out of Tibet to India around 1980. Since we knew each other, we were casually chatting one day. He told me that while he was in a Chinese communist gulag for almost 18 years, he faced danger on a few occasions. I thought he was referring to a threat to his own life, but when I asked, "What danger?" he answered, "Losing compassion toward the Chinese." He considered this to be the danger. Most of us would feel proud to tell others about how angry we got, as if we were some kind of hero. Another Lama, who was from the Drukpa Gagyu tradition, and I were very close. We met frequently and always used to joke, teasing each other back and forth. On one occasion, I asked him about his spiritual experience. He told me that when he was young, he was staying with his Lama, who had him perform the preliminary practice of making 100,000 prostrations to the Buddha, the doctrine, and the spiritual community. Early in the morning and late in the evening, he had to make prostrations on a low platform the length of his body. His Lama was meditating in the dark in the next room, so to trick him into thinking he was making prostrations, he would tap with his knuckles on the prostration platform. Years later, after his Lama passed away, he was taking a meditation retreat in a cave. during which he recalled his lama's great kindness over years of training him, and he wept and wept. He almost fainted, but then experienced the clear light, which he kept continuously practicing. Subsequently, after successful meditations, he occasionally would remember past lives in vivid reflections before him. These firsthand stories have inspired me. There are definitely practitioners today moving in the direction of Buddhahood. Meeting these people increases our inspiration and determination, and through them, the teaching becomes alive. In this way, the spiritual community provides models for practitioners to look up to, which can lead us to refuge. These three, the Buddha, the states of realization and doctrines that teach them, and the spiritual community, are factors outside yourself that have greater capacity to end suffering than you presently do. However, a Buddhist is not asking them to grant happiness. Rather, happiness comes from putting the doctrine into practice. Buddha teaches the actual refuge, how to practice the doctrine, but the main responsibility lies in your own implementation. To create the foundation for an eventual spiritual state devoid of suffering and limitation, we need to engage in the following practice. 1. Identify the 10 non-virtues. 2. Identify the 10 virtues, which are the opposites of those non-virtues. And 3. Abandon the 10 non-virtues and adopt the 10 virtues. Because people vary in their ability to keep certain vows, Buddha described several levels of moral practice. Within the morality of individual liberation, there are those who live a householder's life, in a home rather than a monastery, and those who have left a householder's life to become nuns or monks. If you are capable of maintaining chastity for a lifetime, you can leave the household and take monastic vows. If you cannot maintain chastity, but can keep vows, you can take certain layperson's vows that last an entire lifetime, or other layperson's vows that last for only a day. We find many similarities in the monastic life in all religions: simplicity, devotion through prayer or meditation, and service to others. Christian clergy are especially committed to service in the fields of education, health, and welfare, and Buddhist monastics have much to learn from these Christian traditions. Practice of the morality of individual liberation, whether lay or monastic, leads to contentment. For example, monastics adhere to a limited diet, a small breakfast and then lunch with nothing after that. They have no right to demand, "I want this food or that food." Whatever they are offered on daily rounds of begging, they must accept. Thus, Buddhist monastics are not necessarily vegetarian. Whatever they get, they will eat. That is the training of contentment regarding food. Such contentment alleviates anxiety about getting this or that kind of food. Lay people can emulate this practice by not insisting on special foods. Even if you are rich, you actually cannot consume much more than poor people, except to your own detriment. Both rich and poor have the same stomach. With regard to clothing, monks and nuns are limited to only one set of robes. To own more than one, he or she must get the blessing of another monastic, keeping in mind that the extra robe also belongs to the other person. We cannot wear expensive clothing. Prior to the communist Chinese invasion, monks and nuns sometimes wore luxurious clothes, which amounted to corruption and self-deception. In a way, we could say that the communist Chinese have been kind to us by destroying these corruptions. This limitation in dress is the practice of contentment regarding clothes. Lay people can adopt a similar practice through moderation in dress. The same is true for adornments. Wearing more than one ring on each finger is certainly too much. It is a mistake to think that it is really worthwhile to spend more on food, clothing, and adornments just because you have more money. Rather, spend more on health and education for poor people. This is not forced socialism, but voluntary compassion. Also, it is essential for monastics to be satisfied with adequate shelter. An elaborate home is not allowed. This is called contentment with regard to shelter. Lay people can adapt this practice by reducing the never-ending quest for a better home and for the furniture and decorations in it. Examine your attitudes toward food, clothes, and shelter. By reducing expectations, you will promote contentment. The extra energy which is released should be devoted to meditation and to achieve cessation of problems, corresponding to the fourth and third noble truths. In this way, the three types of contentment are the basis, and the resulting action is called liking meditation and abandonment. We should be contented in material areas, for those are bound by limitation. But we should not be contented with regard to the spiritual, which can be extended limitlessly. Though it is true that a discontented person who owned the whole world might purchase a tourist center on the moon, that person's life is limited, and even the amount that can be owned is limited. It is better right from the beginning to be contented. However, with regard to compassion and altruism, there is no limit, and thus we should not be content with the degree that we have. We are just the opposite. In the spiritual field, we are content with slight amounts of practice and progress, but materially, we always want more and more. It should be the other way around. Everyone needs to practice this, whether lay or monastic. Practicing the morality of individual liberation is also helpful in increasing mindfulness and introspection. If a monastic is about to commit certain acts, even in a dream, he or she realizes, "I'm a monk. I'm a nun. I should not act in this way." Mindfulness comes from a highly developed awareness of your physical and verbal actions, which carries over into dream time. If you pay close attention to your conduct when eating, coming and going, sitting and standing, and so forth, then a strong condition of mindfulness will take hold. The practice of the morality of individual liberation also fosters tolerance and patience. Buddha said that patience is the highest form of asceticism, and through it one can reach nirvana. For monks and nuns, there are four qualities of patience and tolerance to maintain. If someone pushes you around, you should be tolerant, patient. If someone shows you anger, you should not respond with anger. If someone hits you, you should not strike back. If someone embarrasses and insults you, you should not answer back. These practices increase patience. A person who has left the householder's life but hurts someone else is not engaged in proper activity. There are even stories of monks in Tibet who have gone to war. They threw themselves into battle despite Buddha's repeated teaching that to harm anyone else is certainly not virtuous for a monk or nun. Spiritual practice is not about externals, food, clothes, or the like. Spiritual practice takes place in our hearts, in our minds. True change is within. Leave the outside as it is. If your behavior truly reflects an improved mind and heart, that is fine. However, if you are just making a show of your spiritual accomplishments in order to get money, for example, that is hypocrisy. Practicing Buddhism means transforming your attitude. Monastic practices can be incorporated into a layperson's life through a strong, conscious wish to refrain from harming others physically or verbally. This requires patience that will withstand physical and verbal attack. A gradual approach is far better than trying to jump too high too soon. Otherwise, there is great risk and danger. For the time being, contribute to society and practice the teachings. Once you reach a certain degree of experience, you can practice with greater force if you become a monastic. These practices fit together step by step. Usually, my advice for beginners is to be patient. Have fewer expectations of yourself. It is most important to be an honest citizen, a good member of the human community. Whether or not you understand profound ideas, it is important to be a good person wherever you are right now. You should not neglect a greater purpose for the sake of a smaller one. Consider both the present and the long term, in the same way that temporary economic gains should be considered in relation to long-term environmental needs. I like to say that the essence of the Buddha's teaching can be found in two sayings. If possible, you should help others. If that is not possible, at least you should do no harm. Refraining from harming others is the essence of the initial stage of living the teachings of morality. Summary for daily practice. Notice your attachments to food, clothing, and shelter, and adapt monastic practices of contentment to a layperson's life. Be satisfied with adequate food, clothing, and shelter. Use the additional free time for meditation so that you can overcome more problems. Develop a strong desire to refrain from harming others, either physically or verbally, no matter whether you are embarrassed, insulted, reviled, pushed, or hit. Extending help. With the practice of doing no harm as your foundation, now you can cultivate concern for others. First, through the morality of individual liberation, we learn to control anger and the like. And now we can begin learning how to comfort and serve others. The practices described earlier, abandoning the 10 non-virtues, identifying the scope and process of suffering, and the way beyond it through the Four Noble Truths, and adapting the monastic's detachment from transient pleasures to a layperson's life, all these create a necessary background for the second stage, what we call the morality of the great vehicle. Now, not only do you not harm others, but you carry more responsibility for helping them. Not harming others is a defensive practice, whereas the move to help others is proactive. Buddha teaches three stages of morality: the morality of individual liberation, the morality of concern for others, and the morality of Tantra. Helping others is the great vehicle teaching, the heart of the second stage, or Bodhisattva morality. How can you cultivate this other concerned attitude? The main approach for orienting yourself toward caring is to consider your importance relative to others. A practice that traveled from India to Tibet involves first finding common ground with others, which is called equalizing, and then replacing your self-centeredness with other-centeredness, which is called switching. The Indian scholar yogi Shantideva explains this practice of equalizing and switching self and other thoroughly in his Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, and many Tibetans have written commentaries on his text. Real compassion extends to each and every sentient being, not just to friends or family or those in terrible situations. To develop the practice of compassion to its fullest extent, one must practice patience. Shantideva tells us that if the practice of patience really moves your mind and brings about a change, you will begin to see your enemies as the best of friends, even as spiritual guides. Enemies provide us with some of the best opportunities to practice patience, tolerance, and compassion. Shantideva gives us many marvelous examples of this in the form of dialogues between positive and negative aspects of one's own mind. His reflections on compassion and patience have been very useful in my own practice. Read them and your whole soul can be transformed. Here is an example. For a practitioner of love and compassion, an enemy is one of the most important teachers. Without an enemy, you cannot practice tolerance. Without tolerance, you cannot build a sound basis for compassion. So, in order to practice compassion, you should have an enemy. This is because when you face your enemy who is going to hurt you, that is the real time to practice tolerance. Therefore, an enemy is the cause of the practice of tolerance. Tolerance is the effect or result of an enemy. So those are cause and effect. As is said, once something has the relationship of arising from that thing, one cannot consider that thing from which it arises to be a harmer. Therefore, an enemy assists in the production of the effect, which is tolerance. Reflection on this type of reasoning can help develop great patience, which in turn develops powerful compassion. Real compassion is based on reason. Ordinary compassion or love is limited by desire or attachment. If your life is easy and everything is going smoothly, then you can maintain pretenses. However, when you face really desperate situations, there is no time to pretend. You have to deal with reality. Hard times build determination and inner strength. Through them, we can also come to appreciate the uselessness of anger. Instead of getting angry, nurture a deep caring and respect for those who make trouble, because by creating such trying circumstances, they provide us with invaluable opportunities to practice tolerance and patience. My life has not been a happy time. I have had to pass through many difficult experiences, including losing my country to Chinese communist invaders and trying to reestablish our culture in neighboring countries. Yet I regard these difficult periods as among the most important times in my life. Through them, I have gained many new experiences and learned many new ideas. They made me more realistic. When I was young and living high above the city of Lhasa in the Botala Palace, I frequently looked at the life of the city through a telescope. I also learned a lot from the gossip of the sweepers in the palace. They were like my newspaper, relating what the regent was doing and what corruption and scandals were going on. I was always happy to listen, and they were even proud to be telling the Dalai Lama about what was happening in the streets. The harsh events that unfolded after the invasion in 1950 forced me to become directly involved in issues that otherwise would have been kept at a distance. As a result, I have come to prefer a life of committed social action in this world of suffering. The most difficult time for me was after the Chinese had invaded. I was trying to satisfy the invaders so that the situation would not worsen. When a small delegation of Tibetan officials signed a 17-point agreement with the Chinese without the consent of either myself or the government, we were left with no alternative but to attempt to work with the agreement. Many Tibetans resented it, but when they expressed their opposition, the Chinese reacted even more harshly. I was caught in the middle, trying to cool down the situation. The two acting prime ministers, on their own, complained about the conditions to the Chinese government. The Chinese government then asked me to dismiss them. This is the type of problem I had to face day by day as long as we were in Tibet. We could not concentrate on improving our own situation, but I did set up a reform committee to alleviate excessive charges of interest on debts and so forth. Against Chinese wishes, I first visited India in 1956 to celebrate the 2500th year after Buddha's birth. While in India, I had to make the difficult decision of whether to return to Tibet. I was receiving messages about open revolts in eastern Tibet, and many officials in Tibet advised me not to return. Also, from past experience, I knew that as China developed more military strength, their attitude would become more harsh. We could see that there was not much hope, but at that time, it was not clear that we would have a full guarantee of effective support either from the government of India or from another government. In the end, we chose to return to Tibet. But in 1959, after there was a mass escape to India, my situation was easier because the dilemma was gone. We could put all of our energy and time into building a healthy community with modern education for the youth, and at the same time, try to preserve our traditional ways of studying and practicing Buddhism. We were now working in an atmosphere of freedom without fear. My own practice has benefited from a life of great turbulence and trouble. You too can come to see the hardships you endure as deepening your practice. As Shantideva explains the practice of equalizing and switching self and other, first you realize that each and every sentient being wants happiness and does not want suffering, just like you. In this fundamental way, you and they are equal. Then, when you consider that you are only a single person, measured against an infinite number of other sentient beings, you realize that it would be completely ridiculous either to neglect the welfare of others or to use them for the sake of your own pleasure. It would be far more reasonable to dedicate yourself to their service. When you consider the situation this way, it becomes very clear. No matter how important you may be, you are only a single person. You have the same right to be happy as everyone else, but the difference is that you are one, and they are many. To lose the happiness of even a single person is important, but not so important as losing the happiness of many other beings. From this perspective, you can cultivate compassion, love, and respect for others. In a sense, all human beings belong to a single family. We need to embrace the oneness of humanity and show concern for everyone, not just my family or my country or my continent. We must show concern for every being, not just the few who resemble us. Differences of religion, ideology, race, economic system, social system, and government are all secondary. put others first. You yourself come next. This works even from a selfish viewpoint. Let me explain how this is possible. First of all, you want happiness and do not want suffering. Then, if you show other people kindness, love, and respect, they will respond similarly with kindness, love, and respect. This way, your happiness will increase. But if you show other people anger and hatred, they will show you the same, and you will lose your own happiness. So I say, if you are selfish, you should be wisely selfish. Ordinary selfishness focuses only on your own needs. But if you are wisely selfish, you will treat others just as well as you treat those close to you. Ultimately, this strategy will produce more satisfaction, more happiness, even for yourself. So, from a selfish viewpoint, you get better results by respecting others, serving others, and reducing self-centeredness. When you are concerned about others, your own welfare is fulfilled automatically. Consider the physical and verbal non-virtues, these being the causes of being reborn in a bad situation. There are three types of outlooks that lead to avoiding killing, for instance. Someone with a small outlook avoids killing out of a motivation to not accumulate a bad karma imprinted in his or her own mind. Someone with a little broader perspective avoids killing by thinking that it will prevent rebirth in a good life where practice in order to leave the entire round of cyclic existence could be continued. However, altruistic people consider others' lives to be as important as their own, and they avoid murder out of wanting to protect the other person's life. This cherishing of others, therefore, makes a huge difference in the strength of the motivation to restrain from killing. Those whose motivation is self-centered could think that even if they commit such an ill deed, they could confess and seek to ameliorate the karma. However, someone who values another person's life cares about the other's suffering and knows that confessing to murder would not help that person. The same is true for stealing, adultery, lying, divisive talk, harsh speech, and even, I think, senseless chatter. Another way that other concern is so valuable is that it puts your own situation in perspective. At one point, I was particularly saddened about the situation of Tibet. But then I remembered that I had taken the Bodhisattva vows and every day had frequently reflected on Shantideva's prayer, "As long as the sky exists and as long as there are sentient beings, may I remain to help relieve them of all their pain." As soon as I remembered this, the whole feeling of burden immediately cleared away, much like heavy clothes being lifted off of me.